That binds the European Union outlines a gradual ban on Russian oil imports over its war in Ukraine. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a Saudi spy drone over the northwestern city of Hajjah. And also in our headlines, the Chinese capital shuts nearly 200 subway stations and bus routes in an attempt to keep COVID in check. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the European Union has unveiled plans for gradual ban on Russian oil imports as part of its sixth round of sanctions against Russia over its war in Ukraine. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said there would be a complete curb on all Russian oil, seaborne and pipeline crude and refined as well. Russia's biggest bank and the head of the Russian Orthodox Church are included in the sanctions list. However, Russia's gas exports are excluded from the embargo. If approved, countries heavily dependent on Russian oil have to adapt to a new situation. Meanwhile, the German economy minister backed the measure, but warned that the ban could lead to supply disruptions and price hikes. Representatives of the 27-member bloc are set to meet to discuss the plan, which needs unanimous approval to go into effect. We've talked to our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, to get more details about the EU's new sanctions on Russia. Let's listen in.
That this is the sixth round of sanctions being proposed by the European Commission. And as you mentioned, you know, it's a proposal from the European Commission. They formulate the sanctions, and then it's up to the European Council to basically agree on it. That's the 27 member states, the EU leaders. And of course, it has to be rubber stamped finally in the European Parliament. But there are divisions, and that's because, you know, the repercussions, as you mentioned, we heard statements like, you know, the EU doesn't want to shoot itself in the foot during this debate in the European Parliament. But in terms of the sanctions itself, von der Leyen outlined more individuals will be placed on the EU sanction list, more Russian individuals, mainly involved in Russia's military. There's a proposal to take Russia's largest bank out of the SWIFT financial transfer payment system, which is a significant move from a financial perspective. A number of media organizations, more media, Russian media organizations are being banned from EU airwaves. But the big one is the complete ban on the import of Russian oil between now and the end of the year. And no mention specifically of gas, of course. The big questions, some of the questions being asked in the European Parliament today is how might Russia respond? Because, of course, we do import a lot of oil from Russia, but the big one is the gas. And therefore, if Russia decides, for example, to disrupt the supply of gas to more EU countries like we saw in Poland and Bulgaria, what could be the financial implications for the European Union? So a lot of questions like that. Also, lawmakers were asking the questions, do sanctions work? I mean, don't forget, we're talking about six rounds of sanctions now, but I mean, the EU has been applying sanctions on Russia since 2014. And many lawmakers are saying that the sanctions don't work, that sanctions do not work because, you know, the EU is not the case that it's the only show in town for Russia. Russia can also do business with many other countries and so on. Therefore, the effectiveness of the sanctions is being called into question.
A top Russian investigator says the United States has been involved in Ukraine's bioweapons development program. Alexander Bastrikin says the analyses of obtained documents show representatives from the Pentagon and certain American firms have been involved in biological military activities in Ukraine. The Russian investigator says Washington has spent over $224 million since 2008 on such programs in Ukraine. He says the sum has been funneled into about 30 research centers run by Ukraine's defense, health, and agricultural ministries. Russia has long accused Ukraine of pursuing a U.S.-funded bioweapons program, that amid Washington's allegations that Moscow could launch a chemical attack on its western neighbor, a claim the Kremlin vehemently denies. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett says American and Israeli intelligence operatives have been engaged in bio labs in Ukraine since 2005.
We knew over a year ago about these bio labs and their experiments and the documents. We knew about the contractors. We knew about it originally starting in 2005 with the Defense Intelligence Agency that then created a 501c3 called the Global Viral Forecasting Institute with a Zionist Mossad operative named Nathaniel Wolf that then became Metabiota to make it more of a harmless name. And that Metabiota was being funded by Rosemont Fonseca, an investment firm that, ironically enough, Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, was the head of, along with Christopher Hines, who was the son of John Kerry, and Paul Pelosi Jr., the son of Nancy Pelosi. So this is a incestuous, corrupt, criminal racketeering operation that the West has been developing under Obama, under Biden, under for the last 10 years, for the purposes of generating DNA biological chemical warfare to use against the Russians. That's why they've been collecting DNA samples from Slavic people. And of course, all of the documents and the evidence that General Igor Krylyov has found and commented on are all being exposed as revelations of a massive, really war crime, crime against humanity, because it's a violation of the Global Biological Chemical Weapons Agreement.
Russia and Israel are engaged in a row over Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman says Israeli mercenaries are fighting alongside far-right anti-Moscow militants in Ukraine. Maria Zakharova said Israel is certainly aware of teaming up with the militants of the Azov regiment that Russia views as fascists and Nazis. On Tuesday, the Russian Foreign Ministry also accused Tel Aviv of backing what it called the neo-Nazi regime in Kiev. The war of words between the two sides started on Sunday after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Adolf Hitler had Jewish blood. His remarks drew fierce backlash in Israel. The regime has expressed solidarity with Ukraine over an ongoing Russian military operation there. Well, Yemen says its air defenses have shot down a Saudi spy drone flying over its airspace, according to Yemeni media. The drone was downed over the northwestern city of Hajja. Yemen's military has already brought down dozens of drones operated by the Saudi-led coalition in recent years. The incident comes amid a UN-brokered ceasefire agreement reached between the warring sides on April the 1st. Yemen says the coalition has on multiple occasions violated the truce by launching attacks. And China is taking more precautionary measures to contain the spread of COVID, with the capital Beijing shutting down dozens of subway stations and bus routes today after the city recorded 51 infections. Authorities have gradually begun imposing restrictions on people fear they would face sudden stay-at-home orders. Housing compounds with reported infections have already been locked down, while tourist sites are tightening their rules and restaurants closing their doors. The central city of Zhengzhou has also ramped up controls, with residents in some areas remaining in their housing compounds. Officials say the measures are aimed at avoiding the fate of commercial hub Shanghai, where millions have been under strict lockdown for over a month. China has been battling its worst flare-up since the early days of the pandemic. North Korea has test-launched yet another ballistic missile amid worries on the Korean Peninsula over its nuclear program. The South Korean military says it detected the launch in the Sunan area of Pyongyang. It says a missile flew for about 470 kilometers toward the sea off the northeast coast. It comes a week after the North Korean leader vowed to accelerate the development of his country's nuclear arsenal, calling it a symbol of national power. Kim Jong-un also said that the North would not shy away from the preemptive use of nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces. This year alone, North Korea has fired 14 short- and long-range ballistic missiles. The country has doubled down on Kim's military modernization drive as well as missile tests, while ignoring the offer of talks from the United States. New data leak shows a foreign client of the Israeli firm NSO selected over 200 Spanish mobile numbers to target them with its spyware Pegasus. Based on the leak, the selections were made by Morocco in 2019 and were part of more than 50,000 numbers to target by NSO clients worldwide. Just days ago, another revelation showed that Pegasus had infected the phones of Spain's prime minister and defense minister, The government has already launched an investigation. Madrid is also facing questions over how Pegasus was allegedly used to monitor Catalan leaders following a failed 2017 referendum there. Spain was then engaged in a tense diplomatic row with Morocco. Rabat denies spying on any foreign leaders using the Israeli malware. NSO has also rejected any link with the leak, but it's known for selling the spyware to government clients. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses say Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nouri's family as they enter a court building. The footage shows that Swedish police failed to protect the family. Meanwhile, Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials didn't allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as a political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Robert Carter was outside the Stockholm court where a group of MKO supporters was also demonstrating there. Our correspondent spoke with an eyewitness who had seen Hamid Nouri's family being harassed by the members of the terrorist group. Take a listen to what he had to say.
Fantastic. So you're living here in Sweden, an Iranian national, and just tell me, obviously you're not involved in what's going on here at the court, but as an eyewitness you've seen what the group to my right has been up to over the past couple of days, in specific harassment of the family of the accused who have been coming here on a daily basis to witness the proceedings and take part in the court case. Just tell us a little bit about what you've seen.
First of all, I'm really happy that I could find you to open my heart, actually, regarding to what's happening here. These people are known in all Iran history for the past 42 years. And unfortunately, those, I don't like to call them people, but those people standing there are the most hated group in Iran. They are a terrorist organization. They have been terroring, killing, torturing, bombing, and doing many crimes against Iranian civilians.
I think I wanted to ask you one more time exactly what you saw when you saw the harassment taking place. I think if you could describe that in a bit more detail. You saw them harassing the family of Nouri, is that right?
Yeah, the first time actually when I said it, there was a screaming. I was passing here to go to my job. I hear just in Persian language, it's a bunch of people screaming and saying really, really shameful and bad words toward the old woman, which I never have seen it in all my life. It didn't never exist in my world. So I was just shocked by what I'm hearing for the what against a woman walking up to the stairs. All kind of those words, no point.
Administrative detention is an illegal practice that Israel uses extensively and routinely to hold Palestinians. The incarceration has no time limit, and the charges, if any, are never disclosed. The number of Palestinians held under this measure has hit a record high since 2016, but the international community is keeping silent on administrative detention, as it does with the other apartheid practices of the Israeli regime. And this is seen as a green light for Israel to continue its illegal occupation and violation of Palestinians' rights.
An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court. The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson's claim that a lack of knowledge about the asymptomatic transmission of COVID-19 put care homes at risk has been further undermined after it emerged he openly discussed the potential scale of symptom-free transmission. We're prepared for you an article by Michael Savage. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson's Defence on COVID Risk to Care Homes Hit by New Revelation. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson's claim that a lack of knowledge about the asymptomatic transmission of COVID-19 put care homes at risk has been further undermined after it emerged he openly discussed the potential scale of symptom-free transmission. The Prime Minister has already been accused of misleading Parliament over the claim. He made it recently after the High Court ruled that the government had acted unlawfully in ordering the discharge of patients in hospital to care homes without testing in the spring of 2020. Boris Johnson told the House of Commons, "What we didn't know in particular was that COVID could be transmitted asymptomatically." However, the Prime Minister commented on papers examining the issue at a COVID press conference on 25th of March, just several weeks before rules were altered to ensure that all patients were tested before they were admitted to a care home. At the press conference, he asked Chief Scientific Advisor Sir Patrick Vallance about reports that many people could have the disease without symptoms. He said, "Patrick, on the number of people who have the disease asymptomatically, there was a study I saw quoted from some Oxford academics saying that as many as 5% may have had it asymptomatically. How do you evaluate that at this stage?" Sir Patrick Vallance said studies in China and Italy had pointed to asymptomatic cases, but the role of those cases at a population-wide level was unknown. He also said that new antibody tests would be able to work out how many people have had the disease asymptomatically, and that's going to be important to understand what to do next. He added, "These tests are crucially important. We need more of them." Care homes emerge as a major casualty in the first COVID wave. In mid-March of 2020, National Health Service England had told hospitals to urgently discharge patients to help free 15,000 beds. Compulsory tests were not introduced for discharged patients until 15th of April. About 25,000 patients were discharged to care homes in the intervening period. Recent High Court judgment listed several occasions in early 2020 when the risk of asymptomatic transmission was raised by scientists and by ministers. A submission from the government's own lawyer stated that there can be no doubt that the government understood that it was possible that asymptomatic people could bring the virus into care homes. A government spokesman responded to the findings by stating the court recognised this was a very difficult decision at the start of the pandemic. Evidence on asymptomatic transmission was uncertain. Martin Green, chief executive of Care England, said that even if there was not proof of asymptomatic transmission, ministers should have erred on the side of caution, as the risks were known, adding, "The SAGE Government Advisory Committee had identified the issue of asymptomatic transmissions in early 2020. But if there was any doubt about issues relating to transmission pathways, then this should have led to a clear directive that no one should be transferred between any health and care settings without a COVID test." Prime Minister Boris Johnson also acknowledged in a press conference on 18th of March that the problems the virus posed. Johnson said, "The thing about this disease, it's an invisible enemy and we don't know who's transmitting it. But the great thing about having a test to see whether you've had it or not is suddenly a green light goes on above your head." If he did not understand that meant people without obvious symptoms might be among those transmitting the virus, other people were on hand to point it out. Lord Bethell, then a junior health minister, was explicit about this during a Lords debate on 9th of March 2020 about the government's first COVID regulations, which created the power to keep people in isolation if they posed a health risk. He told members of the House of Lords, "Large numbers of people are infected and infectious, but completely asymptomatic, and never go near a test kit." At that point, the public was told that the incubation period for COVID could be as long as 14 days, and most people did not develop symptoms until about 3 to 5 days after. There was no proof at that stage how COVID was transmitted, prompting advice about hand washing rather than wearing face masks. But the high level of infectiousness and the possibility of asymptomatic transmission were being actively discussed by scientists and commentators. The Imperial College, University of London report that was so influential to the government's initial response to the virus and which led to widespread antipathy among lockdown sceptics towards its chief author, Professor Neil Ferguson, stated that they assumed symptomatic individuals are 50% more infectious than asymptomatic individuals. A government spokesperson said that was being clear about the understanding of the virus changing over time and that it changed significantly day by day, particularly at the start of the pandemic. They claimed the vast majority of the recent court judgment found in the government's favour and that evidence on asymptomatic transmission was extremely uncertain. They asserted, "Our thoughts are with all those who lost their loved ones during the pandemic. Throughout the pandemic, our aim has been to protect the public from the threat to life and health posed by COVID-19, and we specifically sought to safeguard care home residents based on the best information available at the time."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Ardam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
SubhanAllah.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the jurisprudential laws of prayer, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, we all know that as a Muslim, there are four chapters in the Quran or four surahs that have, which we call it, obligatory sajda or prostration,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But is it permissible for us or for one to include one of these verses, the verses of prostration or the verses that require prostration and sajda in the prayer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are people who are curious.
Yes.
And out of curiosity, they ask this question, and I have come across many such questions.
Yes.
From people who want to know whether it's permissible to recite a surah which contains an obligatory sajda. Obviously, according to the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and also Grand Ayatollah Sistani, mm-hmm. it is not permissible to recite a surah which contains obligatory sajda. If a person happens to recite it, then he should perform the sajda within the prayer. He should perform the sajda within the prayer, and then he should continue with the prayers. And then the thing is that because this sajda might have affected his prayer, mm-hmm. it is necessary, according to both the religious authorities, to repeat the prayer.
Right.
Because in the middle of prayer, he has done something which wasn't necessary in the first place. He should not have done it, because he has added two sajdas, and then included the sajda which is not a part of the obligatory prayers at all. But he has deliberately and consciously actually recited a surah which requires him to perform sajda. And of course, his eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, has said that it's not permissible in the first place. But if he does it, he should do the sajda wajib immediately, and then he should restart. He should complete his prayer, and then do the same prayer over again.
Uh-huh.
Yes, the same prayer over again.
I see. As a precaution.
As a measure of precaution.
Yes, I see. Okay, what about a person who hears the recitation of such an ayah, you know, that requires obligatory sajda? How should she or he go about it?
Well, I've checked with the Risala or the Manual of Islamic Laws written by both the religious authorities. They have said that he should complete his prayers, and then after the prayer, he should do the sajda, mm-hmm. the sajda or sajda wajib. For the recitation of the Holy Quran.
In whatever position that he is. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our discussion about prayer here in this program, Islamic Laws.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the jurisprudential laws of prayer, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law or jurisprudential status of reciting the zikr of the prayers, loudly, or opposite, whisperingly,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I understand that many people do not follow this rule while praying. We all know that in the morning, or it must make a difference, right?
Yeah.
The morning prayer with the, what do you call it, the Zuhr prayer, the noon prayer, right?
They should be the Zuhr in the midday or the Zuhr in afternoon prayers.
Yes.
Should be
silent.
Should be silent.
Yes.
And it's not permissible to recite them or to read them out or recite them loudly.
Yes, and these rules, in fact, we are talking about apply to the men, right? Not the women?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Right. So what are the Islamic laws about them?
Yeah, if a person intentionally prays loudly where he should pray silently,
yes.
Maybe vice versa, mm-hmm. his prayer is obviously wide. His prayer is wide,
yes.
Because he's gone against the Islamic Sharia law, against the law of religion.
Yes.
But if he does it owing to forgetfulness or not knowing the rule or maybe by mistake, which often happens, I know, because I've seen many young men and young boys, of course, they... not young boys in the sense that they are not adult yet. Mm-hmm. They have attained puberty. They are supposed to offer their prayers, but maybe they are in a hurry. Of course, they sometimes forget to offer the Maghrib and Isha prayers and also the Fajr prayers loudly. So, if a person happens to forget reciting the Fajr prayers and the two rakas of the Maghrib and Isha prayers loudly, then of course, his prayer is not affected because he has been forgetful. A person who forgets is not to blame. And indeed, if he realizes that he is doing a mistake, for example,
yes.
While reciting the Surah Al-Hamd, of course, in the other Surah, which is usually Surah Ikhlas recited in the prayer, it is not necessary for him to recite again and repeat the prayer, mm-hmm. of course. So it is very much important to know that one should not deliberately and intentionally recite the first two rakats of Maghrib and the first two rakats of Isha prayers, as well as the Fajr prayers in low voice, or in whispering voice.
Mm-hmm.
He should recite them loudly. And when it comes to the Dhuhr and Asr prayers, of course, it is necessary for a man to recite them in as low voice as possible, you know. But they yes. should be, for example, clear and distinct. You know, it's not permissible to just pass the words through one's mind and recite nothing, you know.
I see.
Maybe some people might think that, okay, we should not not utter anything because it will be audible for a person who is standing next to you.
Yes.
Okay. No, that's not intended. That's not what the religious authorities mean. You should recite it distinctly, clearly, but not loudly.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's a very quick question that might squeeze in here, you know, because we don't have much time to
yes.
the end of the program. When we say how loud are we talking about?
Oh, that's also a good question. It's not permissible to shout,
yes.
to raise your voice to the extent that everyone starts, if getting scared,
yes.
you know,
or it makes a mayhem around.
Yeah, you're right.
Or a fuss.
So it should be in a way you like. Sometimes you speak to someone sitting in front of you.
Yes.
Okay. It should be audible. And of course,
like in a small room,
in
should
a small
be heard,
room.
Right?
Yeah, should be heard. Okay, because if you start shouting, then
yes.
you are actually making noise.
Yes,
you may be disturbing others. In
I
addition,
see.
It's not considered to be a kind of prayer
yes.
because you are losing your composure. You are being relaxed. You know what can I call it?
Yes.
You know your steadiness.
Yes.
Or
composure.
Yeah, composure. And when you're not deemed to be offering prayers in that case, if you make a loud noise,
mm-hmm.
noise. Yes.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much, Javed, for your contribution to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, and we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim Malja ilaha illahum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami. لا إله إلا الله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
A new Oxfam analysis finds that 99% of humanity is worse off due to COVID-19, while the world's 10 richest men have doubled their fortunes during the pandemic. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After 2 years of COVID, report finds pandemic made for deadlier by greed. Here's the story. If a single word can encapsulate why, 2 years into the global COVID-19 pandemic, the virus continues to spread widely and kill thousands of people each day despite the availability of life-saving vaccines. The humanitarian group Oxfam International suggested that the word is greed. In a new report titled Pandemic of Greed, Oxfam offers a grave assessment of the current state of the public health emergency in an effort to bury the notion that the coronavirus is on its way out and normality is on the horizon, a rosy and potentially dangerous sentiment voiced in recent days by the leaders of rich nations and the executives of powerful pharmaceutical companies. While effective vaccines provide hope, their rollout has tipped from a natural desire to protect citizens into nationalism, greed, and self-interest, reads Oxfam's report compiled on behalf of the People's Vaccine Alliance, adding, large numbers of people in low-income countries face the virus unprotected, and millions of people would still be alive today if they had had access to a vaccine. Big pharmaceutical corporations have been given free rein to prioritize profits ahead of vaccine equality. Published almost exactly 2 years after the World Health Organization WHO officially declared the novel coronavirus a global pandemic, Oxfam's analysis brings together a slew of data points that, taken together, paint a picture far more dire than the one U.S. President Joe Biden presented during his closely watched State of the Union address recently. Biden said in his speech, because of the progress we've made, because of your resilience and the tools we have tonight, I can say we are moving forward safely back to more normal routines. Oxfam's report counters that. In the United States, where vaccination rates are lower than in Europe, the deaths from COVID-19 have remained high, on a par with previous waves of the pandemic. More broadly, the group notes an estimated 99% of humanity are worse off because of COVID-19, 160 million people have been pushed into poverty, and 137 million people have lost their jobs. While the pandemic has had far-reaching and destructive consequences, touching countless lives directly and indirectly across the planet, Oxfam makes clear in its new report that not everyone's livelihood has been harmed by the public health catastrophe. The report notes the richest 10 men doubled their fortunes during the pandemic, and a new billionaire is being created every 26 hours. Of those new billionaires, 40 of them have made their billions profiting from vaccines, treatments, tests, and personal protective equipment. Oxfam emphasizes that the pain inflicted by COVID-19 has been disproportionately concentrated in poor countries, which have been denied sufficient access to vaccines by rich nations and profit-seeking pharmaceutical giants that have hoarded doses and technology. Mazar Sayoum, Global South Convener for the People's Vaccine Alliance, said in a statement recently, rich countries and corporations have tied up the global response to COVID-19 for their own benefit, leaving the Global South to bear the brunt of this pandemic. As billions of people are still unable to access vaccines, some have the audacity to claim that the pandemic is over. That is an utter fallacy. Third and fourth doses in rich countries alone cannot erase the ever-rising death toll in lower-income countries. To convey the extent of the pandemic's devastating impact on low-income countries, Oxfam's report observes, for every life lost in a rich country, another four people have died in a poorer nation. 54% of all deaths caused by COVID-19 have been in low- and lower-middle-income countries, where 10.6 million people have died. 2.7 million people are estimated to have died in high-income countries, 14% of global deaths. People in poorer nations are 1.3 times more likely to die as a result of the pandemic compared to rich countries. Per capita deaths in low- and lower-middle-income countries are 31% higher than in high-income countries. Every minute, four children around the world lose a parent or caregiver as a result of the pandemic. Almost half of these children are in India, where over 2 million children have been affected by orphanhood. Worldwide, Oxfam estimates that 19.6 million people have died as a result of the pandemic. That figure, which includes deaths directly and indirectly caused by COVID-19, is far higher than the official estimate of roughly 6 million deaths from the virus alone. At least 3 million people have died since the highly contagious Omicron variant was detected by South African scientists in November. The only way to prevent the emergence of new mutations and finally end the pandemic, Oxfam argues, is an urgent change in a strategy that includes a suspension of coronavirus-related patent protections, the transfer of vaccine technology to developing countries, and a massive increase in funds for global vaccine manufacturing. According to one recent study, producing and distributing 3 coronavirus vaccine doses to every person in low- and lower-middle-income countries would prevent over 1 million deaths for the cost of $61 billion, a fraction of the $778 billion U.S. military budget. To date, just 13% of people in low-income countries have received at least one coronavirus vaccine dose. Anna Marriott, Oxfam's health policy manager, in a statement said, "After 2 years, we all want this pandemic to be over. But politicians in rich countries are exploiting that fatigue to ignore the devastating impact of COVID-19 that continues to this day." While incredibly effective vaccines provided hope, rich countries derailed the global vaccine rollout with nationalism, greed, and self-interest. Marriott added, "Suggestions that we are entering a post-COVID era ignore the continuing deaths in primarily lower-income countries that could be prevented by vaccines."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and a very noble hadith and tradition, which has been narrated from Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth Imam of the family of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And this hadith is about flattering transgressors, meaning praising them, flattering them with the hopes of getting something out of it, you know. In fact, this is something which has been mentioned in the Holy Quran, and in a verse of the Holy Quran, God Almighty says, "Who are eager that you should be pliable so that they may be pliable towards you." Imam Baqir alayhi salam in this beautiful hadith says the following: Allah revealed to the Prophet Shu'aib. So in fact, this is one of those hadith-e-Qudsi. Hadith al-Qudsi is a tradition and a hadith in which God speaks in the first person. Right? You might be speaking to a prophet, you might be speaking to a great person, right? Such as, who might not be a prophet, but nevertheless is a wise person, is a great person, like the prophet Luqman, like the sage Luqman. But in this tradition, the Imam alayhi salam mentions this sacred tradition and Hadith al-Qudsi. God Almighty revealed the following to Prophet Shu'aib: "Verily, I am punishing 100,000 members of your community." A lot of people. 40,000 from among the evildoers and 60,000 from among the good doers. When the Prophet Shu'aib alayhi salam heard this, he was surprised and he was amazed. So he asked, My Lord, evildoers fine, but what about the good doers? Meaning, why would you punish so many good doers? What have they done? Why do they deserve punishment? Then Allah, mighty and exalted, answered him by revealing the following to him. This was because they were pliable with the transgressors and did not express any anger at what anger means. Meaning these people were amongst transgressors, were amongst sinners, but they did not express any regret and any anger at what these people were doing. These people were sinning in front of them, they were transgressing in front of them, but these people, they didn't mention anything to them. They didn't try to stop them, right? They were pliable to them. They might even have been flattering them to get their affairs accomplished and done, right? They didn't do Amr bil Ma'ruf, they didn't enjoy the good, or Nahi an al Munkar, they didn't forbid the evil. This led them to incur God's wrath, and God punished 60,000 good people from amongst the community and the ummah of Shu'aib alayhi salam. So this is a very dangerous act, and we should be careful of it. In a similar tradition, Imam Ali says, the worst of your brothers is he who flatters you and conceals you from your faults, or conceals your faults from you. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at flattering the transgressors in the words of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump sponsored the so-called Abraham Accords between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, promising peace nearly 2 years ago. Sudan and Morocco followed their lead shortly afterwards. Since then, Saudi Arabia has been the silent party and the virtual signatory to the normalization process, waiting for the right moment to make its position public. But it seems like the two sides are showing their tendencies for normalization more overtly.